What's better than earning money from a 9-to-5 job? It's earning money while you sleep, which is made possible if you start investing. You're listening to the Real Estate Investing Demystified with your very own dynamic duo, Ava Benesaki and August Binias. Tune in as we discuss everything real estate, both on the passive and active sides. We feature life-changing stories of today's real estate leaders that will help build your own roadmap to success. This is a show that will lead you to a diversified portfolio, a much bigger revenue, and a next-level venture that brings you a smooth cash flow. Let's get this episode started. All right, welcome back to Real Estate Investing Demystified. This is our second show of the day.
Second show of the day.
Yes.
Well, don't give any of our trade secrets, okay?
Why not?
These things take months to prepare. The show is a production. It takes a whole day to put it together. Don't say we're doing two shows in a day, but no.
Sometimes people reach out and they're like, hey, you guys missed a week or something. And I'm like, well, you know, life is busy. We have two babies now. August is a big skier going up in the Black Diamonds.
Double Black Diamond.
Oh God, I'm trying to get him not to kill himself now that he's a father of two.
I'm actually skiing better for survival purposes, you know, so
nice.
I noticed that.
Nice.
But yeah, let's kind of bring the attention to today's show.
We're excited.
I actually recently attended Harvard for the private equity venture capital program. I'll talk about why it relates to our guest today, but you know, it was a program they offered. I got accepted. I attended Boston, yeah. And it was incredible. 65 other people were there from all around the world. Only 8 people from the 65 were from the U.S. I live part-time in the U.S., so I was one of those 8 people, but majority of people from all over the world. Super exciting, learned a lot, but having learned lots about private equity and venture capital and about how deals are structured, I learned about so many different ways that a deal could be put together. And when you talk about private equity, venture capital, you're mainly talking about buying companies, not real estate, even though a lot of private equity firms, they have a huge allocation in real estate. Blackstone, I think, has more allocation to real estate than they do when it comes to leverage buyouts or mergers and acquisitions. But yeah, about how these deals are structured, the entities that get created. For example, I learned about this thing called secondaries. Secondaries, when there's a main fund, so Blackstone puts together a fund, they have it's usually a 10-year lifespan the fund has, but then secondaries are when somebody else puts together another fund that allows investors to have access to the main fund that they wouldn't otherwise, because only particular institutions can have access to that main fund. The secondaries allows for that. But our guest today, that is a good friend of the show and of our company, he's going to talk to us about the mechanics of some of these fund of funds, feeder funds. You know, we're going to talk about co-GPs. How do you go about finding these fund of fund managers? Because in my personal opinion, fund of funds might actually be a better way than working directly in some ways, working directly with a sponsor or a general partner, because a fund of fund manager is out there looking for the best general partner to invest with.
Yeah.
And as long as the investors are not being diluted, that's the best way to go about it, because that fund of fund manager is looking for the best sponsor, looking for the best real estate investor, cherry picking the best sponsor, cherry picking the best deals. Looking for the best economics for their investors. But I did enough talking. Let's get into the show and bring our guest on. Maybe you can give a quick background about who our guest is.
I would absolutely love to. Today, we're joined by Randy Smith, and he's the founder of Impact Equity, leveraging 25 years in corporate sales and leadership to help investors achieve financial freedom through passive real estate investments. So since launching Impact Equity in 2022, he has assisted 115 plus investors in placing $9 million across 17 projects with 6 top tier operators. As a limited partner himself in 25 investments spanning 12 operators and 8 asset classes, he brings deep expertise in due diligence and transparency. Now in 2024, he founded Raise Capital in Coaching and Consulting to support new capital raisers and professionalize real estate fundraising. Randy also co-hosts the Gentle Art of Crushing It podcast and resides in Peoria, Arizona with his wife, Jenny. So welcome to the show, Randy. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. Really excited to be here with you guys.
Amazing, amazing. So Randy, let's jump into things. You had a successful career in corporate America. First of all, what did you do in corporate America? Give us your background there. And then what made you leave corporate America to then start your career in real estate?
Yeah, thank you. So I was a sales guy for 25 years in corporate America. I started out in a small computer company in Los Angeles, dialing for dollars, and then moved over to a larger Fortune 100, Fortune 200 organization for the next 20 years, where I led sales teams, I set up phone sales centers, and spent the last 10 years of my career carrying the bag again and managing territories with Fortune 100 and Fortune 200 organizations. So 25 years of sales experience, primarily dealing with solving complex technology and service-related issues for my clients.
Okay, incredible. And you know what? I always, having that sales background obviously ties into what you're doing today. And I really wanted to kind of just jump right into capital raising and start kind of discussing capital raising in the show. Sure. Because I'd like to get your perspective on capital raising. So I have my own thesis is at CPI Capital. I'm more focused on the equity side of the business. But with capital raising, I mean, for myself, I've intimately spoken to thousands of investors. You know, I have close relationships with hundreds of investors. But I feel that capital raising is truly an art, right? You have to master the art of capital raising. And there's so many ways to go about it. There's the hard sale. There's the soft approach. There's, you know, the fear of missing out approach. There's, obviously, it's very important, relationship building. You can be pushy. You can stand back a little bit more, have investors come to you. But I wanted to get your perspective because there's tons of, obviously, books and resources out there where people can kind of try their best to master the art of capital raising. But you launched Raise Capital Coaching and Consulting Program. So talk to us about your perspective of how you connect and really approach investors, how you create relationships with them, and then how do you teach others to raise capital? Maybe you can walk us through the process.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an interesting question. I think that the very best salespeople in the world are not really salespeople at all. They're just folks that are having engaging conversations where they're truly trying to bring value and help the people that they're working with. So, you know, as a sales professional, I think ultimately having true, authentic relationships with your investors or potential investors is really the best way to build trust and build confidence from them. And eventually they invest with people they know, like, and trust. And the way you build that know, like, and trust is just by spending time with them in various different venues, various different touch points, and just gradually over time building trust from them. So I think that there's a lot of pushy, almost manipulative, salesy techniques that can be used in the space. And I personally choose not to go down that path because I think this is more often than not, I'm dealing generally with the less sophisticated investor, folks that are either newly accredited or about to be accredited investors. And I really think it takes that teacher's mentality to really educate and inspire them to get involved in the space versus trying to convince or coerce or kind of push somebody into investing in the space. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess there are a lot of folks that have invested in this space over the last handful of years that possibly should not have invested in the first place. And I think it's better in the long run for investors, for operators, for us to be choosing the right people to participate in these, because the investor that shouldn't be invested, that is, will ultimately it causes harm to them and it causes harm to everybody that's involved personally. So I think it's important to make sure that we're putting the right people in these type of investments personally.
Yeah, absolutely. And then talking about, and yeah, I'm totally with you there. I think there's two main things you need to be, you have to take a genuine approach and then have a great investment opportunity, right? And let them ask questions and don't use big words, you know, to try to, you know, sound like you know it all. And yeah, I totally agree with you there.
The big words part, just for me to jump in there, we had an associate of ours on one of our deals a couple of years ago, and he spoke tremendously incredible when it comes to private equity language. And I looked up to him a lot. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy was like, I really looked up to him because of, you know, the words he was using. And when we had a presentation for our investors, the amount of complaints that Ava got was mind-blowing. Because to me, he was incredible as the words he was using and the private equity language he was using. But to the investors, they hated it. They're like, we don't understand half the things this guy is saying. So
what is all this
that's
mean?
A great point you guys are making.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think that's a really big piece of what we do is taking what can be a fairly complex idea and breaking it down in very simple to understand terms and relating it to other things that maybe they already have some type of understanding with. So if you come in and you start talking, just much like you said, if you start talking at a much higher level than where their sophistication is, ultimately it's going to go right over their head and you're not doing them any service by by talking down to them or talking at a level that they're not going to understand. So
yeah, absolutely. And you know, investors can really read the person that's on the other side of the screen, right? Are they, you know, they can tell if you're being genuine or if you're just trying to sell them on something. So I absolutely love your mindset on that. Raise capital. Talk to us about how do you teach others to raise capital when they come on your platform? Do you, you know, help them with how to connect with investors, how to interact with the investors, how to nurture the investors on an ongoing basis? Talk to us about
how to get leads, possibly.
How to connect.
So the RAISE strategy, which is just an acronym for the 5-step process that I teach people to go through, usually for their first or early raises that they're doing. And the R in the acronym stands for relaying your story to your avatar. So we spend a lot of time like digging into their personal journey, their origin story, helping them relay that information in a way that's going to help capture the interest and the emotion of the person that they're talking to. Because going back to that initial thought, where people connect with people they know, like, and trust, and people will know, like, and trust people that they are very similar to. So if we can help them relay that story and really touch on points that are going to grab that emotion, then that will likely lead to a better result for everybody. The avatar piece is very, very simple, where I generally will teach folks to focus on somebody who's a previous version of who they are. So myself, as an example, I was a high income sales guy. So I focus on talking to and working with potential investors that are high income sales professionals, either technology professionals or financial services professionals, because we speak the same language. We connect. I know the problems they have. I know the challenges they have. I know the fears they have about getting laid off or, you know, all of those different types of things. So that's the R. The A is the attract portion, where we dig into, specifically, I focus on LinkedIn, because that's where I had most of my success. When I first launched Impact Equity, I just simply messaged everybody that I was already connected with, which were old colleagues and clients of mine. And I was able to raise a significant amount of capital in a very short period of time. So I've taken the skills that I've used in sales for 15 years in LinkedIn, and I try to kind of streamline that down to literally 2 or 3 different slides about best practices, about leveraging LinkedIn to attract investors. I is the identify portion, which is just simply due diligence. Like, how do we find good operators? How do we find good partners? I've got a 100+ point due diligence process that I take people through to show them how I find the best operators. And in today's marketplace, unfortunately, most operators aren't going to get through the first 10 questions that we go through. So it's really a good way to filter through those operators that I personally don't think that less sophisticated investors should be investing with. And then the S is, how do you structure? So we talk a lot about fund to fund. We talk about syndication, co-GP, JV, and just help people understand what's going to work best for them. Mm-hmm. Folks that are getting started in this space, quite often, if they're operators, they don't need to jump right into syndication right away. Quite often, JV can make a lot of sense. Simple promissory notes can make a lot of sense, and they don't have to jump in and spend all the money on the others. And then finally, I take them through the engage or the nurturing process, where we talk about CRM, we talk about portals, and we talk about email marketing. So
incredible. Full stop.
Step process. Yeah.
Full stop shop.
Yes. That's amazing.
Yeah. Go ahead. Do you have a follow-up question?
No, I was just going to say that's really great, because we built everything from the ground up here at CPI Capital. So it's nice for, you'd provide that service for people to come to you and learn everything that needs to happen.
Yeah. I like to take a step back.
Sure.
I feel maybe we jumped in really quick into kind of the bulk of the conversation. But taking a step back, you're in corporate sales. You get involved in real estate at some point. This is your focus. You're a fund manager now. Talk to us about your transition. We also, Ava, read in your bio that you also invested as an LP. Maybe you can start with, how did you get snagged in somebody trying to pitch you, or did you go looking for it? Talk to us about starting there.
Yeah.
So my journey was much like a lot of folks. When I started to accumulate some wealth as a sales guy, I decided I was maxing out my 401k and needed to find a place to put the additional capital that I was earning. So I started buying single family, like so many do. I tried turnkey. I didn't care for that. I tried the burst strategy and bought a bunch of houses in Atlanta and found out pretty quickly I wasn't going to be able to scale that while I was in my W-2 to the level that I would need to replace a strong 6-figure income. So I started looking at multifamily and thought about jumping in and buying apartments from day one. But quite honestly, it scared me. These were much bigger checks than I was writing for these small single families. So I decided to passively invest. to take a peek behind the curtains and see if the syndication was something that I wanted to do in the long run, and really kind of move my career in that direction. And what I found...
Briefly describe what syndication is.
Yeah, syndication is just a pooling of investor funds to help purchase an asset. So you get an operator who is... generally what will happen is an operator, they're doing their own deals. At some point, they run out of money, so they need to start raising money from other folks. So they open it up to their closer network through a 506B opportunity. In doing so, they're able to bring on investor capital and then go buy bigger assets, and they can focus solely on that. So syndication, the term syndication can actually be used in all kinds of different things. Where I first heard about it was like movie syndication or television show syndication, and it's the same concept.
Syndicated mortgages is the first time I ever heard about it years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's used in all different types of places, but commercial real estate, it just means pooling investor capital to pair up with an operator where you have passive investors that get all the benefits of investing in real estate, and they leave the dirty work to folks like you guys and many of the other great operators.
So you weren't actually looking for this. You wanted to invest in it for the benefits it had, for the income you had. Keep going from there, please. Sorry.
Yeah. So from there, I made the decision to passively invest to see if I even wanted to jump into the space. And I just fell in love with passive investing. Like, it was great. I just, no more tenants and toilets, no more property managers. I just literally could spend my time finding the very best operators and then place my capital with them. And more often than not, they're going to get me better returns than I would get if I was putting my own dollars into my own deals, because they're professionals. They have huge teams. They have resources. They have the skills and the time, energy, effort that I didn't have as a full-time employee to dedicate to that business. So it just made more sense for me to spend my time focusing on sales in my career, because that's what I was very good at. That was my zone of genius. That was my superpower. So I would just make great money there, get the bonus checks, place them with the large operators that were much more professional and skilled at this. And then everybody wins. And I find even today, I think even if you're in this space as an operator, you still need to have a way to make money, and then you need a place to place that capital. And if you've got both of those together, it's just a great combination.
Absolutely. And at this time, did you have a asset class that you were focused in, or did you have a region that was your region that you wanted to invest in?
Yeah. So my initial due diligence was not anywhere near what it is today. And I'm embarrassed to say that my first passive investment I made because I really liked this podcast and this one operator that I was listening to on the podcast, who happened to have a very big beard. You might know who I'm talking about. And he just happened to invest in mobile homes, which made a lot of sense at the time. So early due diligence was finding people on podcasts that I liked, scheduling calls, getting on with them, and then placing what I know now, placing probably too big a checks in too few of deals, because I didn't get the diversification that I actually strive for today. So
of course. Now talk to us about, you figure out this way of passively investing. Talk to us about, at what point did you even think about leaving your career and getting into this business where you also provide a service for others who are going to use the same strategy to be able to invest into these investments?
Yeah. So I would love to tell you that I had this master plan that I was going to step away from the W-2 and do this full time. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I actually was laid off from my W-2 job in June of 22. So after 10 years being a top producer, I fell victim to the layoffs that happened so many times that we're hearing so much about. But fortunately, I had been investing in real estate for about 5 years at that point, and a very large percentage of my household expenses were covered by my passive income. So it gave me the option, and it gave me the choice, do I go back and do I chase another job, which I could have got another job. In fact, I think I had two job offers within a week of being laid off. But by having this passive income coming, it planted in the seed that there is an opportunity for me to go all in now and truly chase the dreams and the aspirations that I had, to go all in real estate. And the passive income that I had gave me the freedom to really do that. So that's when I jumped in and formed Impact Equity.
Nice. Now, for us, Ava and I were in real estate most of our career. When we got involved in real estate private equity, there was obviously, in our case, there were some complexities because we're also investing from Canada into the U.S. Now we have offices both in Canada and the U.S., and we partner with both Canadian and U.S. investors. But early on, the vision was allowing Canadian retail investors to have exposure to U.S. real estate, particularly multifamily. So there was some complexity when it came to cross-border investing and what have you, and finding the right tax opinion, because every tax advisor we spoke to had their own opinion on the tax law.
Sure, but
aside from those difficulties, we also had difficulties just understanding about the mechanics of how these deals are put together. What is a LLC or a limited partnership? What is the relationship between GP, LP? How could you bring on JV partners within a syndicated deal? Should we go to fund route or a syndication route or project-specific route? So there was a lot of learning that we tried our best to learn it through the information that was available online, but doing a deal while we partner with another group taught us a lot. And it was a pretty difficult partnership, unfortunately, with a couple of groups we partnered with. But we learned lots, because in life, sometimes you get the best experiences from some of your worst experiences. So in our case, sure, you've learned a lot from partnering with a couple of groups. They didn't have a big beard. So, but yeah, going back. So, but how about yourself? When you know that, hey, I'm pretty good at this thing to redirect my own money into these investments. I've made some good decisions. I've made some money here. Maybe I can turn this into a business. How did you immerse yourself to learn about the actual mechanics of how these things are put together? Because there's no real course out there. I mean, the course I went to helps, but it's more kind of 30,000 view. Is how did you learn how these things are structured? Was there a mastermind you joined? Talk to us about that.
And you probably learned from personal experience too by being part.
But he was just an LP.
But as an LP, you get to still read the document, you know, on the PPM, kind of learn about the process, get the monthly emails or quarterly emails that some operators provide. So you kind of learn a little bit on a high level.
Got it.
And then, obviously, fair enough, you can dive deeper.
Yeah. Certainly experience from investing as an LP certainly helped. And I don't know that I would even jumped into the space without doing that early on, which, you know, to folks that are actually considering getting into the space, I think it makes a lot of sense to invest in, you know, one or two or five or 10 different deals before you even jump into the space, just so you can truly see what it is that you're getting into and how operations work. And peeking behind the curtains is a big, big deal, I think, in the space, to know what's truly going on. Also, it gives you some credibility when you're talking to investors that you've done what you're asking them to do. So you've sat in the chair, or I think you've wired the money where they told you all of the fears about, you know, all the scams that go on with wiring money, all of that stuff, right? So with that being said, I had invested very heavily with an operator here in Arizona. And being a sales guy, I talked to everybody that I knew in corporate America about what I was doing. And after a certain amount of time, people started asking me what I was involved with. Could they get involved with it? Could they also invest in it? So I reached out to that operator and asked, is there a way that I could make introductions and make some money, you know, to try to monetize my network while I was still in my W-2? And I was informed that, you know, you can't really get paid for bringing dollars to a deal because of transaction-based compensation. Mm-hmm. And he suggested that there was this model called the fund of funds or fund model that would allow me to set up my own entity where my network could invest into my funds, and then we could place those funds into another investment, an already identified asset. And at the time, when I was in my W-2, I didn't think that I wanted to jump in that heavily, that quickly, because I thought it would pull me away from what I was doing in my W-2. But the second I got laid off, he was the very first phone call that I made. And next thing you know, I was up and running in that space. So I did a number of projects with them. And then I decided that I wanted to be able to provide diversification to my investors with one single point of contact being me. And then I would be kind of the conduit that would open up well-vetted investment opportunities to my network. And leveraging the fund model allows me to do single asset funds with a bunch of different operators and then share those with my investors so they get the diversification that they're craving.
Just to understand this a bit more, so you have your own master feeder fund. Investors invest into that fund, and then you select what deals you want to invest in? Do the investors get exposure to every deal you're investing in?
So good question. So there's a few different ways that these funds are set up. Some are what is called a customizable fund, where you have a single fund and you bring in multiple projects, can be at the same time or at different times. And then the investors pick and choose, I'm going to invest X amount of dollars and I want it to go into these investments. That's a customizable fund. I've chose not to go down that path. I actually do single asset funds, which already has the asset identified. So an operator like yourself comes to me and says, hey, I've got a deal. Are you interested in this? I say yes or no, and make a commitment on X amount of dollars that I'm going to bring to the deal. After we have that agreement in place, then I go to my SEC attorney who drafts the documents, and then I share that deal with my investors, but it's already attached to that specific deal.
Right.
And I don't have any options where the dollars go. So single asset, identified asset, fund of funds.
Project-specific right. fund that you put together for one specific deal that you've already the sponsor and the deal. Yeah, I mean, continuing on the conversation, any questions that came up for you at this stage?
I was just thinking.
I always take your questions that come up right after. But
yeah, whatever on top of my mind. What I was thinking, actually, and I just wanted to make one more point about you being a passive investor. And this is actually a conversation that I have with a lot of our investors or people that I'm talking to, meeting for the first time, is for you, because you were a passive investor with so many different operators, you kind of see how you were treated as a passive investor, right? What kind of communication was done, how transparent that operator was. This is huge for passive investors. You know, believe it or not, CPI Capital, we're the best in the business when it comes to communications, and we get lots of compliments on that. And I always ask new investors, hey, so you've invested as an LP before, you know, what kind of communication do you get? And they're always kind of like, you know, every quarter, you know, I'm not very happy with the communication.
Most of them is once a year.
Exactly. So it's really interesting learning. So you probably learned that by being a passive investor, as well as I want to be treated as a passive investor. And what kind of communication should you now?
But the question here, not to answer the question for Randy, the issue that might come up here is the sponsor that Randy is working with, they might not be providing, I'm just saying, they might not be providing monthly updates. How is Randy going to extract that information and send his monthly update to his investors? Is that something that's ever...
Yeah, so it's a great question. Different operators have different cadence that they share their information, and that's something that I like to vet on the front end. So probably the single most important change that I've made to my due diligence process in the last year or so is I ask for the most recent investor updates. So I will get either their most recent monthly or their most recent quarterly update, and then I can review that and see how the asset's performing, which is quite telling in many different situations where you find out things through the reports that they haven't openly shared with you. But yes, I am somewhat at, you know, I'm at the mercy of the communication that they share with me. So in situations, all of the operators that I'm working with, I have a regular quarterly one-on-one meeting with each of the operators I work with. So at a minimum, I'm going to have those quarterly updates that I share the information with my investors, but all of the operators I choose, they either have monthly or quarterly updates that are very detailed, consistent format that I just simply take their reports and then share them with my investors through the portal that I use.
Yeah. See, it's such an important topic that he literally put that as part of his vetting process when he's a partner with the GP.
So,
And I will tell you guys that now that I've started to do a lot of consulting in the space, a lot of the mid-sized operators, small to mid-sized operators, they don't have those types of systems in place that do regular communications with investors. So it's always kind of the last to-do list that seems to get done when they're putting out fires. Sure, they're responding to investors if they reach out to them, but there's no regular cadence in that. So the fact that you guys at CPI have those in place, you're honoring that. That is a huge win for you guys. And it really is something that would differentiate you from a very large percentage of the mid-size operators that are out there today.
Yes, Randy, every single month on the 20th at 6 a.m. EST, our investors hear from us. And we will never miss that, right? They need to have that trust with us that they're going to know exactly what's happening. So that is something that
Let me explain the logic there.
We stick by, yeah.
The logic there, like my belief is that, you know, especially as a newer firm, as a boutique firm, you have to leverage all the best attributes that you have. So yep. You might not have a long track record. You might not have billions of dollars in AUM. You might not have over 100 employees. So try to leverage whatever you're good at.
Yeah.
If that is reporting. Put attention on resources and have the best reporting out there.
Yeah.
Right? Because other firms, they don't need to have good reporting because investors, they've just been around for so long that investors are investing, or they just know about that one particular product, or that product is on the shelf of financial advisors, or they're a REIT. So, you know, their access to funds are a lot easier, or they have institutional investors who don't want such reporting. They just want annual reporting. So, you know, leveraging your best attributes.
Yeah, and really making an experience for the investors, taking them on a journey. Like these real kind of smaller real estate, private equity firm syndication model is really connecting with these high net worth investors, but giving them the best experience. It's exciting for them. They can go talk to their friends and family about it, and they feel like they're really part of something. So yeah, that's something that.
Last thing I want to cover.
Doing.
I want to get a few more important things. So
yeah, time's flying.
Now, in this space that we're in Canada, is known as the exempt market. In the US, is known as the private placement market, the alternative investment space that's outside of Wall Street. You don't have financial advisors offering the products we offer to investors. And so we're kind of left alone on our own means to go and find and connect with investors. And marketing is a great way, kind of becoming a thought leader in the space is a great way to connect with investors. But we're kind of left at our own peril. Aside from you connecting with investors who want to invest with you, and I will get to that question in a moment, how do you find operators, sponsors, or simply said, real estate investors that you want to partner? How do you go about finding them?
From an operator standpoint or an investor standpoint?
Operator.
Yeah, so it's evolved quite a bit. Early on, it was very much with podcasts, you know, the standard books. Like you listen to one podcast, they suggest another podcast, which suggests a book. You go down the rabbit hole there. I started joining masterminds and communities a few years ago, and I'm part of a men's entrepreneur mastermind called GoAbundance, which is, call it 1,000+ entrepreneurs. There's a very, very large passive investing community in there that is extremely sophisticated, with folks that are writing significantly larger checks than I could ever cash. I won't say that because I'm not currently cashing today. I'll just say that. So I got around a community of passive investors that are amazing at vetting deals and vetting operators. And I have, about the first year or so, I just kind of sat on the sidelines and listened to what everybody was saying. We have WhatsApp channels where literally there's 100 messages a day where they're vetting deals, the good and the bad and the ugly about all kinds of deals that are out there. And I started seeing common themes about operators that were coming up, both good and bad, and started pursuing relationships with those that were being spoken very well about repeatedly in that community. And that's where I started working with a group called DLP Capital, which is a very large group out of Florida, $5 billion fund. We do a debt fund through. I started talking with a group called Post Real Estate Group out of Beverly Hills, another very large operator, 15, 20 year track record, 100+ assets. Started working with a group called Vantage Point Acquisitions, which is Andrew Cushman, who oddly enough was interviewed by the guy with the beard 9 years ago when I first started listening to podcasts. So the single best way to find investments is through another investor that's placed capital and has had a good experience, and then they introduce you to that operator. So that's the strategy I use today and where I find most of my new partners.
Give us like your top five questions to vet that you would ask yourself when you're vetting an operator.
The first one is track record, which you have to ask, right? So track record, how long you've been doing this? How many full cycle deals? What have the results been? Second one is, can I see your most recent investor updates, right? Which is a big one. Like this operator that I'm working with, Post, they have 100 assets. They sent me 100 documents that I spent hours and hours and hours sorting through to make sure that everything was running well. From there, you know, it kind of comes back to like that interview skill that you get. Being in sales for 25 years, I feel like I can spend some time with somebody and kind of see through the BS. So digging in and asking questions about when things don't go well, when something didn't go right, how did you handle it? Those types of things. So I like to dig into those. And if an operator ever tells you that we've never had anything like that happen, then I say run, because there's not an operator out there with any experience that's not run into really, really difficult times.
Yeah.
Certainly if they've been through the down cycles. So
of course, gut feeling is a big part of it. How would like personal, like a lot of these companies have, you know, business development individuals. So you might not be dealing with like the executive team themselves, but in a case that you are dealing with the C-suite, is there, do you look at any kind of personal alignments? Is the person very transparent? Are they very open to provide information? Are they enjoyable to be around? Is that ever, I think we discussed this on your podcast. Is that ever something that matters? Is that material or that's immaterial?
No, I think these are 5+ year marriages at a minimum. So absolutely. There are operators out there that have fantastic track records, that have never done bad deals with their investors, that everything's, you know, they answer everything right. But if I just don't like them, I'm not going to do a deal with them, because I don't want to spend the next 5 to 7 to 10 years dealing with somebody that I don't like. So yeah, it might sound petty, but at the end of the day, there's plenty of good operators out there that I get along with just fine, that I think is a better choice for me personally.
Absolutely. So, word of advice, if you're a GP looking for a fund of fund partners, don't be passive aggressive. It's never going to work out. All right, great. So I think we covered a lot of information there. Let's talk about on as far as kind of market, few somewhat rapid fire questions, but you can be as extensive as you wish. What are the markets you're currently looking at?
Currently looking at primarily Texas, Carolinas, basically, I would say the grin states. So it's kind of the smile states, but actually towards the southeast more.
So. Okay. Got it.
We just coined that phrase just now, the green states.
Sure.
Because you hear smile states, yeah.
We'll attribute it to you. Fair enough. How about asset class? Is it multifamily focused?
So probably 80% multifamily. I do like mobile home. I like storage. I like industrial for my own investment dollars. I've not jumped into that arena just yet for my investors, but likely to see a new asset class this year.
Sounds good. And then as far as where the economy is going, real estate is cyclical. It goes in these constant cycles. It has for a couple of hundred years. You know, it goes through recovery, expansion, hypersupply. Sorry, recession, recovery, expansion, hypersupply. I was so afraid of recession, I didn't even mention it. Your focus is multifamily. If the multifamily real estate cycle was a clock, and 12 o'clock being top of the market, 6 o'clock being the bottom, what time is it today?
I think we're at 9 o'clock. I think we're coming out of the bottom. We're about to go into the next 2 to 3 years where deliveries are going to be down. And I think we're going to see interest rates probably remain flat, maybe dropping slightly. But I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity that's coming on from people that bought deals with floating rate debt that the bank is not going to keep kicking the can down the road. So we're going to see some good opportunities. I think now is the time to be investing in multifamily, personally, far better than when I got into the business. Unfortunately, investors are scared right now. So it is more difficult, I think, than ever to raise capital. But now is the time to get
But what you're saying doesn't match your time. It sounds more like you mean 6:30, but 9 o'clock means we've already come off the bottom. It's already an uptick and the market is picking up. So you might be talking about maybe between 6 and 7, actually.
I think you're probably right. Yeah.
All right. Because I was listening to him. I'm like, no, he means something else than he said. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
From everything, let's get to the second segment of the show. You know,
all right.
Does it the best.
Let's do this, Randy. The 10 championship rounds to financial freedom. We're going to ask you a series of questions, whatever comes top of mind. Are you ready?
I am ready, I think.
All right. Here we go. First question. Who's been the most influential person in your life?
What comes to mind is Jim Rohn. I listen to Jim Rohn CDs constantly, so that's who I'll go with, Jim Rohn.
All right.
Just a little background on who he is. Just very
brief. Yeah, so Jim Rohn is, I think he was Tony Robbins' mentor. He was the personal development guy back in the, I want to say, in the 70s. So, yeah.
A lot of people have his tapes. I think I've heard people listening to his tapes in their car, like actual cassette tapes.
Exactly. Yep.
Right. Oh, nice. Okay. Next question. What's the number one book you'd recommend?
Who Not How. Ryan, Benjamin Hardy.
No, Dan Sullivan, you mean?
Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy.
There you go.
They co-authored that.
Yep. There you go.
They have a whole series. There are 4 or 5 books that they did together are all fantastic.
Yep. All right. Awesome. Dan's marketing is better. So all I remember is Dan Sullivan's name.
That book changed my life. Anyway, next question. If you had the opportunity to travel back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Just start earlier. Like, don't sit on the sidelines, jump in. I am a ready, fire, aim guy today. I haven't always been that guy. I would just say start sooner.
Nice. Love it. Next question. What's the best investment you've ever made? You did make 25 of them, plus probably others. So what's the best investment you've ever made?
Best investment I ever made. I will say it's probably the very first investment that I made in the space. Because without that first investment, I would have never made the others. So
nice.
It was a single family purchase. I didn't make a whole lot of money on it, but it actually led me into Birth, where I did really well and ultimately landed me here in the syndication space.
Amazing. All right. Now, what's the worst investment you've ever made and what lessons did you learn from it?
Yeah. So worst investment I ever made was in an ATM fund, which essentially turned out to be a Ponzi scheme.
Oh, wow.
And yes, that was hands down the worst one I ever did. And I did that probably because I followed some groupthink and did not do my own due diligence.
Got it. I had a bunch of emails a few years ago for an ATM fund that came through me. It was actually a doctor advertising it, but
oh, really?
That might be somebody.
Be glad you passed, because it's probably the same one.
Right, okay. All right. Next question, Randy. How much would you need in the bank to retire today? What's your number?
So it's something like, to completely step away, it's probably in the high three, low 4 million range.
Okay. Right on. Perfect. Yep. He's got to figure it out. Next question is, if you could have dinner with someone dead or alive, who would it be?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I would actually say my grandfather, oddly enough. He was not a wealthy man, but he was probably one of the best men I ever knew. He was a printer in Los Angeles and family guy. That's probably him. It's actually his anniversary that he passed away today. So that's why I'm thinking of it today.
Oh, wow. Okay.
40 years ago. Yeah.
Was it paternal, maternal?
Maternal.
Maternal. Okay. Yeah. I was very close to my maternal grandfather as well. So. Yeah. Rest in peace to all the grandfathers out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go.
Next question. If you weren't doing what you're doing today, what would you be doing now?
It would probably just be sales, be back in the sales role, honestly. Yeah.
Nice.
How about anything outside of business? Is there any dreams or hopes, being an athlete, being a mountain climber, or just anything that was outside of the world of business that ever interested you if you didn't have to work, that you would be doing that?
Yeah. So there is... I like giving back to the community. So it could be something in that arena. I'm not sure exactly what it would be, but there would probably be something helping underserved populations.
Yeah. Something nonprofit. Amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. All right, Randy, book smarts or street smarts?
Street smarts.
Nice.
There you go.
And last question. If you had $1 million in cash and you had to make one investment today, what would it be?
It would probably be something in a debt fund arena. That would just be a cash flow investment.
Right. As long as it's got instant redemption rights.
Good point. Yes, absolutely. Awesome. Great question. No lockup period at all. Yes.
Yep. All right, great. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming on. Really enjoyed it. We've discussed and had chatted before. So I'm glad to get to see you again. And thanks for coming on the show. It was awesome.
Thanks for being here, Randy. Just quickly before you leave, let everybody know the best way that they can reach you, please.
I spend most of my time on LinkedIn. Or my website is impactequity.net.
Awesome. Thanks, Randy.
We'll share it in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. We hope this conversation enlightened you on how to win big in this highly profitable and risk-averse space. Get on your feet and embrace this world that offers so many opportunities just waiting for you out there. Continue your journey to becoming a savvy real estate expert by subscribing to the show at cpicapital.ca. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and share with your friends. See you on the next one.